Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
You see, at the top of the pyramid, the eye. The eye is the reminder to everyone who sees it that we are everywhere. We see everything. There's nothing that we don't know.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We own RBS, but you'd never know it. The bank's global restructuring group has been killing off healthy family businesses for profit. Yes, the Royal Bank of Scotland, despite being owned and controlled supposedly by the Treasury and you and I, is waging war on hard-working families if it thinks it can make a fast buck. Plus, Monday was Holocaust Memorial Day. We hear about a new parliamentary Holocaust Commission. And we look at links to whistleblower Edward Snowden's revelation that NATO governments are committing criminal offences, compiling massive databases on every single one of us. Everybody is now an NSA and GCHQ suspect, and it's all happening behind the veil of so-called national security. Plus, carried over from last week, former US Marine Ken O'Keefe will tell us what really happened, supposedly anyway, on the 9/11 attacks. Is another investigation into that day going to help? If not, what is? But before all that, I'm joined on the line by journalist, blogger and author of Shredded, The Rise and Fall of RBS. That's Ian Fraser. Hi, Ian, and welcome to The Politics Show. OK, well, he was there a minute ago. He suddenly has disappeared. What I'll do is I'll just ask Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, whilst we're trying to get Ian back, to explain a few things about these banks that have been nationalised, like RBS and Lloyds. Martin, what is actually the difference between a bank that's still in the private sector, that is to say, like Barclays and HSBC, and these nationalised ones, which are NatWest is one of them, Lloyds is one, and RBS is another?
Well, when these banks were nationalised, the Labour government at the time made it clear that they were not going to take a hands-on approach to managing them. A mistake, in my view. But of course, what they're trying to do is pretend that basically everything's all right, and that ultimately what we're doing here is that these banks will eventually be back in the private sector. So what you've actually got is a situation where the bank RBS is in fact thinking of itself in the future as being a private bank, and once it is a private bank, of course, they in other words, they're trying to make profits so that they can be sold back into the private sector. If they were being run as nationalised banks, they would actually be, you could for example insist that they do lend to small businesses and don't try and bankrupt them. But of course, what they're trying to do is make their bottom line look good so that they can be sold back into the private sector, and when they are sold back into the private sector, the assets of those small businesses will then be hoovered up by the sharks whoever will by RBS when and if it is privatised.
Well, thanks, Martin. We are now, glad to say, joined by Ian Fraser. Hi, Ian. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Stop.
Take us back a bit through your journalistic background.
OK, well, I worked as a journalist in London between about 89 and 99, so for a decade, various different titles, and was also freelance. And then I moved to Scotland in 99 to help launch a new paper called The Sunday Herald, which is quite a radical paper based in Glasgow. I left that in 2006, and I've been freelance ever since. I've worked with the BBC making a few documentaries and writing for a wide range of different newspapers and other outfits, including the Naked Capitalism blog in the US, and Q Finance, which is a new venture that I'm helping with, launched by Bloomsbury Publishing. So yeah, it's a wide range of different things. But I think I've become more and more critical of the financial services sector, especially since the crash of 2007-08, because before that I was kind of neutral about banks and financial institutions. But I think since then I've looked at them with a much more critical
Now, you mentioned they're working with the BBC. How have you found it? I mean, have you really felt that they have given you a voice, made sure that some of the criticisms that you're putting to the financial system are aired to the public?
It's quite problematic because their lawyers, it's normally not the actual journalists I work with, it's normally the lawyers who are ultra-cautious and tend to block anything that's, you know, revealing fraud, for example, or too controversial.
Well, can you give us just an idea? I know it's a bit cheeky, but can you give us an idea of the sort of thing that they were saying, well, we can't really say that, we might not want to talk about that? Because, I mean, clearly there is an attempt to play down some of the criminal activity of the banks. I mean, we know we've had LIBOR fraud, we've had money laundering. These are all very serious criminal acts, and yet a lot of them are given these kind of sort of mealy-mouthed names by big organisations like the BBC. They will call them, for example, mis-selling. So give us an idea of the sort of thing that the lawyers have been getting a bit too nervous about.
It's actually, I'd love to do it, but it's a little bit sensitive because, you know, I did sign a contract with BBC when I agreed to work as a freelance journalist on some of these programs. But, I mean, it's just that you've got all your ducks in a row, you know, up to near the final stage when the thing's about to be going on air. And you'll find that the lawyers have, for some reason, taken fright at some particular claims because they feel there isn't enough evidence, and then they'll be kind of wanting you to produce, you know, really, really copper-bottomed evidence to prove that the fraud or whatever it is has taken place, or it might be another thing, you know, it could be something else, some other crime, and in the end, you aren't able to broadcast that particular part of the package, and it's intensely frustrating. I do think lawyers are probably, you know, they haven't changed their mindset since the crash. That's the problem. A lot of lawyers, they tend to be stuck in a pre-crash mindset, which is, you know, that you can trust financial institutions or whatever. And I don't know how you get around it. But I think there's also there was a collective loss of nerve at the BBC, and I think, according to people I've spoken to there, it really happened after the Andrew Gilligan and Hutton Inquiry debacle. You know, they really were, as you know, they were seriously chastised after that episode. And there was, I think, what they've called a collective loss of nerve, which they still haven't fully recovered from.
Yeah, there is obviously some, you know, real problems with reporting this stuff when lawyers are saying, no, you can't print that, even though this is something that, you know, you would argue should be at least discussed, you know, maybe with someone putting the opposite point of view.
Yeah.
But I mean, let's get back to talking about RBS, this book that's about to be published by you.
Yeah.
Tell us, how did we come to own RBS?
Well, basically, the bank was, you know, bust in 7th of October 2008, it was within a few hours of complete meltdown. It was the largest financial institution in the world. The next biggest was Citigroup, which was two-thirds of its size, had assets of $3 trillion. And the government was absolutely shit-scared. You know, Darling and Brown and Miners and other members of the cabinet were just really shitting bricks because if this thing had toppled over and gone bust like Lehman had a few weeks earlier, it would have brought down the entire economy, and it would have actually, you know, it could have had some serious international repercussions as well. But the reason for it is basically it was very, very badly managed. Goodwin, the guy who ran it from 2000 to 2008, a guy called Fred Goodwin, was ridiculously obsessed with scale. He wanted to grow a bank which would be as large as, say, HSBC or bigger than Citigroup, but to do it in 7 years rather than many decades, which is what those banks took to grow to the size they are. So if you want to grow something, you know, if you want to grow from a small Edinburgh-based bank mainly serving the Scottish market to being a global titan with offices in hundreds of countries worldwide, and you want to do it in the space of 7 years, you're going to take a lot of risks, and you're going to, you know, you're at risk of, for example, being hoodwinked when you buy other banks. The people selling those banks will pretend they're good, solid institutions when actually they're not. And you'll end up buying some real dross, which is what he did with Charter One in the States. And it's what he did with ABN AMRO. I mean, also just generally lending recklessly, because if you want to grow your balance sheet fast, you tend to take on more risk. You're lending to people who perhaps are not good, very good bets, who might go bust, but just because you want to issue the loans, you'll lend them, and you'll lend them billions. So, he had a whole division called the Leverage Finance Division, which was lending, scores of billions to companies without properly investigating them and without properly doing due diligence on their business plans.
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, Ian, looking back now, what would have happened if the government had just simply done the market thing, that is, to just let the bank collapse? Would there really have been a massive economic disaster which would have destroyed Britain and sent waves right out around the Western world?
Not necessarily. I think they were kind of overreacting. I think you could have resolved it, is the fashionable word. You could have resolved RBS in different ways. You could have ring-fenced the vital part, which is the UK payments system and UK retail and commercial banking side. And you could have, gone and put the rest into liquidation. So there were lots of other ways that it could have been done. But at that particular juncture, on the 7th of October 2008, Brown, Darling, and the rest didn't really didn't seem to think they'd had time to find alternative solutions.
Now, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, but just to get your view on this, because it does sound as if, to a certain extent, the senior people in the Labour Party back in 2008 may have been bounced into this decision to bail out RBS and the others.
Well, I think they certainly were bounced into it. I mean, the week before the crash, Brown was in the City of London at the Lord Mayor's banquet, going on about a wonderful job the city was doing. So clearly he was taken completely by surprise. And looking back with hindsight now, I mean, how have we got a bank based in Britain which has got a GDP bigger than Britain? And, and it's the international implications of allowing it to collapse which would have been the most serious. I mean, the British economy would have been collateral damage. But the fact is that the international financial system is based in Wall Street and the City of London, and the whole thing would go down. And we're now getting a situation where, effectively, the British state and the US state is bailing out the international banking system. Can this be sustained? I suspect not.
What are your thoughts on that one, Ian?
Well, just on the timing, I think Martin had the timing slightly wrong, because when Brown spoke to the bankers, and I can't quite think of the word, but he was basically eulogising the bankers at a banquet. He was eulogising the bankers at the banquet. That was actually in June 2007, which was his last day as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And so that was like 18 months before, or no, that was 16 months before the bank collapsed. But on the broader point, I think to an effect, the British state, the British taxpayer has been bailing out the international financial markets through the bailouts that occurred in October 2008. And, one might question whether that's appropriate, whether that's an appropriate use of our money.
OK, so how does RBS compare to the other nationalised banks? That's Lloyds and NatWest and maybe others.
Culturally, I think it has some real issues. I mean, researching the book, it became quite obvious that the guy who Darling chose to take over from Goodwin, who's a man called Stephen Hester, has done absolutely nothing to improve the culture of the bank. In fact, people tell me it's now far more poisonous internally than it was. But also, as we found out from the Lawrence Tomlinson revelations in the last few weeks, they have, been deliberately massacring small and medium-sized enterprises in order to profit from their demise, by basically asset stripping them.
I mean, surely they look at these businesses and they say, well, actually, even though it's just about turning a profit now, into the future it won't do that. So it makes sense actually to get our money back now while we can, and in the future we may not be able to get our money back. So that's a decision, surely, a commercial decision at the bank.
It's difficult to know what the exact thinking is, when they decide to deliberately engineer a default in an otherwise profitable, otherwise stable, otherwise creditworthy company.
I suppose the other side of the coin is, of course, if a company is delivering profits, then you may as well keep it going, because you close it down, it doesn't do that anymore.
Well, exactly. So that's what you'd have thought. But I mean, to really get to the bottom of this, you need to speak to a whistleblower from inside GRG, which is the department of the bank that does this. But you know, I have spoken to approximately 100 companies to which it has happened, of all sizes, you know, ranging from quite big ones with turnovers of more than 50 million a year to quite small ones with turnovers of around about a million a year. And, you know, none of them are particularly happy that the bank has destroyed their business for seemingly no reason other than to profit from its demise. But I don't quite understand the thinking within RBS at a high level which prompted them to go down this particular route. But it's certainly one which they will live to regret, because I think it's quite possible that some of the top guys will end up going to jail because of it.
Well, just give us... you've spoken to a lot of people who've suffered under the global restructuring group, the GRG. Can you just take us through what they've experienced? You know, the first hint, maybe, that RBS were deciding to close them down.
Okay, well the first thing that happens is that, you know, they're kind of... The word I use is tripped up, or, you know, that something happens, which is that the bank suddenly doubles the rate of interest on their lending, you know, or else the bank suddenly pulls their funding or says they've got to pay back their overdraft within 48 hours, or it values properties at what seem like fraudulently low levels. So, for example, if a hotel was valued at, say, £3 million, the bank, and even, say, 6 months ago, the bank sends in a firm of surveyors who have a proclivity to produce very low valuations, and they say, well, actually, this hotel's only worth £790,000, so, you know, less than two-thirds of what it was supposedly worth 6 months earlier. But that means that the company is in breach of its covenant, because the lending is based on the loan being a certain percentage of the value of the asset. Do you know what I mean? So basically, a situation occurs, and it's not in every single case of the ones that I'm aware of, it's not the fault of the company, it's the fault of the bank engineering a situation whereby the company is suddenly technically in breach of covenant or in default on its loan. Then what happens is the company finds it's transferred to Global Restructuring Group, and Global Restructuring Group is missold or misrepresented by the bank as a place which will help put you back on your feet. It's described as a sort of, you know, the equivalent of a sort of intensive care ward, or a place where the company will be well looked after and will find that, you know, within a few months it can go back to normal trading and back into the normal part of the bank. But actually this isn't what happens, because as soon as they get in there, the companies find they're saddled with sudden charges of £20,000 a month, or, you know, 30,000 a month, or they suddenly have to get something called an independent business review from PricewaterhouseCoopers, which will cost them $100,000, which is often skewed, you know, against them I don't quite know, but these IBRs aren't as independent as they are supposed to, you know, as they are meant to be.
Well, the last thing you need, is it, if you're facing a bank that's saying that they may pull your loan, is an instant bill that comes out of the blue for $100,000.
Well, I know. They're basically hitting these supposedly vulnerable companies with massive, massive additional fees and costs and charges and increased interest rates and basically making it impossible for them to trade. And I think, you know, the idea that it's actually this kind of kindly sort of intensive care unit, or, you know, nurturing place where we'll put you back on your feet is just a total lie, because it isn't. In every single case of the ones that I've spoken to, they have been, the second they're in there, they've been saddled with these massive additional fees, charges, and raised interest rates, etc.
Now, have any of the companies that have been victimised in this way fought back successfully, legally? Because, I mean, one would have thought that, you know, suddenly if your lender puts unreasonable charges on you, then they could also be breaking their contract.
Well, I'm aware of three three or four which have taken RBS to court. In all three of the cases, the people, or the business directors, the directors of the businesses, won in the initial hearings, in the initial cases, but then in every single case, RBS has appealed, and in every single case, the appeal, which is normally in front of three judges instead of one, has gone in favour of RBS. But in one case, they're now going to the Supreme Court, because... And one of the issues here, by the way, is that when companies do sue RBS, RBS gets incredibly vindictive, and you know it's what they will kind of persecute the company or the business person concerned at a, both a personal and a business level.
Well, give us an example of that on a personal level. That sounds a little bit over the top, persecuting somebody as an individual.
Well, it is, but that's what they do. I mean, there's a guy called Derek Carlisle, who I've written about on my blog. And the bank actually said, "We will destroy you, you know, and your family." These were their words. "We will destroy you and your family," and they did. You know, they basically they go for him. And another thing that can happen, you know, if on a totally separate level you have a mortgage with them, they can suddenly remove that and they can get hold of your house. Other things that have been known to happen include. Intimidating the solicitors that you're using and telling them, you know, we're gonna hound you or whatever. I don't know what they do, but using certain forms of intimidation to frighten them off representing you if you're one of these people. So you know they're a very, very nasty, very, very malicious, very, very vindictive institution. I mean, it's astonishing that this is a state, you know, 81% owned by the UK government, but it is, and unfortunately it does act in this way. I don't know what we're going to do about it, but I thought that when Tomlinson came out with his report on the 25th of November last year, that it might represent some kind of turning point, that you know, maybe the MPs would wake up to the fact that this bank is behaving very badly, but they've been pretty slow to respond, to be honest.
Okay, well, there is always, of course, a recourse to the law, as you were saying, this case chugging its way through the system, ending up at the Supreme Court. But yeah. But ultimately, how are these banks regulated? I mean, we heard a lot about, oh, we're going to have better regulation of the banks. We've had the end of the Financial Services Authority. What's taken its place, and is that going to be effective?
They're not really properly regulated at all. I mean, the FCA basically is a follow-on from the FSA.
So that's the Financial Conduct Authority, I think, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it's supposedly looking at the Lawrence Tomlinson allegations, if that's the right word. Actually, commercial lending is not a regulated activity. So basically it's the Wild West out there, you know, within the parameters of contract law or the way that, you know, within the parameters of how contracts are policed by the courts. The whole area of corporate and commercial lending is an unregulated activity. The banks can more or less do what they choose.
Amazing. I mean, it almost makes it sound, where you're painting the picture there, Ian, as a bunch of loan sharks with a business which is bigger than a country, but bigger than Britain.
Well, it is. That's quite a good way of describing it. I hadn't thought of it like that, but it is, you know, and it's just... very, very unsatisfactory.
I mean, are there any ways, do you think, of making the regulator actually do its job properly? Or is it, you know, something which has actually been captured, Martin, I'll put this to you, captured by the private banks themselves?
Well, I don't think it's gone that far. I mean, they're basically doing what they like. They're not being regulated at all. It's not that the regulators have been captured. It seems to me that they're engaged in a process of looting. And you could, it's an insider fraud, control fraud, I think is the technical term for it. So the people running RBS are not RBS, and they will walk away with whatever they walk away with. I think the incentives are wrong for a nationalised bank. They are being told that you've got to get back into profit, you've got to wipe out all your debts so that we can sell you back to the private sector. And I think that was the position of the new Labour government, and that's the position of the current government. Now, of course, if you're not going to do that, then you're going to say, well, we've got a nationalised bank, what are we going to do with it? And then you've got to have a plan. And, of course, the politicians are running scared of that because they don't want to actually take responsibility situation. They're just hoping that it'll sort itself out. These people know what they're doing, leave it to them, and eventually the taxpayer will get their money back. But I suspect what's going to happen with all of this is it's all going to crash again, possibly this year or the following year, and then we're not going to get any of our money back, and of course the state won't be able to step in a second time.
Now, there's been also some news, I think, today, Ian Fraser I'm speaking to, who's a financial journalist. He's the author of a forthcoming book, Shredded, The Rise and Fall of RBS. Now, about pension funds, Ian, and particularly the Sainsbury's Pension Fund and the Royal Mail Pension Fund.
Yeah, well, this is an extraordinary story involving a supplier called State Street, which produces fund management services, or delivers fund management services to pension funds. It also does what's called custodianship, which is looking after share certificates and doing all the back office work for fund management firms and pension funds. But yeah, this is a very alarming story whereby, you know, State Street seems to have been siphoning out cash from these pension funds, basically putting in fraudulent additional fees. And it was fined. To be fair to the FCA, they have actually done something. They have actually fined it £23 million or something today for doing what it was doing. But there's also a separate issue about the individual person who was behind this. Well, I don't know quite what to call it. It was the additional fees and surrogate charges that were being put on pension funds, including the Royal Mail and the Sainsbury's Pension Fund. And, the person behind it, who was called Ed Pennings, who used to run State Street, State Street's transition management team in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, was found guilty of gross misconduct in February 2013. And he's a Dutch guy, and he claimed he didn't understand some of the words which were used in the court case. But, in the Employment Tribunal, sorry. The wider issue here is that I think that there's a real issue to do with pension fund management, which is that often the trustees of pension funds, some of which have tens of billions of pounds in them, by the way, and are looking after the money of current employees of the organization concerned and retirees of the organization concerned, are often very naive. So there's a problem that, you know, the trustees of some of these large pension funds have no previous experience of the financial services sector and no previous experience of the City of London. And arguably they, you know, get sold a bad deal when they go in to meet asset management teams or whatever in the City of London and end up agreeing to fees and charges which could be significantly less than the amount they're actually paying. So yeah, this State Street thing is probably, you know, I don't know if it's the tip of the iceberg, but it's indicative of a wider problem, which is one of overcharging by city-based concerns of, you know, where pension funds are concerned.
I mean, it is a pretty depressing picture, Ian. I always hear it in your voice there. You know, what we're doing is explaining just how appallingly badly regulated and actually criminalised the banking system seems to be becoming. But let's just, I mean, we've had payment protection insurance fraud, which people like to call, certainly the BBC, I'm sure, would prefer to call mis-selling. We've had LIBOR fraud. We've had interest rate swap fraud. We've had foreign exchange fraud from the banking system. We've had money laundering on an epic scale with some of the most murderous drug cartels in the world, particularly by HSBC. Is there any other, what do you think might be next on the line? I mean, the last one of those I think we've heard about is foreign exchange fraud. I wonder if you think, what you think about that, and maybe are there any other frauds that haven't yet been discovered that the bankers are up to?
I think foreign exchange rigging of benchmarks is a massive fraud, and it will eclipse the LIBOR fraud in, you know, the level of potential losses that have been incurred on pension funds, on other mutual funds and other investment vehicles and other investors. So I think, you know, whereas the LIBOR situation, which first erupted in June 2012 when Barclays reached a settlement with the regulators, was described as banking's tobacco moment, in that it was the moment when the tables turned and people realised that, with tobacco, people realised that smoking kills, and the key moment was that the tobacco companies acknowledged that there for the first time, and this I think was in the, when was it, the 80s? 90s? The tobacco companies for the first time acknowledged that smoking actually does cause lung cancer and does kill you. And it was a key moment for the tobacco sector, where it automatically became a pariah, and it, and for the next 15 years or so, there was just ongoing litigation whereby tobacco companies lost billions because of people suing them after relations, had died as a result of smoking their products. That was in the US. So, sorry, it's a bit long-winded, but I think the LIBOR thing, we don't really know if that was banking's tobacco moment yet, but if it isn't, then I definitely think that this foreign exchange market rigging will be banking's tobacco moment.
Now, the obvious thing to be doing is obviously prosecuting, jailing. I mean, that's been very successful over in Iceland. They've now got a genuinely healthy economy over there after jailing bankers and dealing with it. Is there anything you think should be done on that on those scale? Because it seems that what's happening is out-of-court settlements, fines, nobody is actually personally going in the dock who's responsible. You would imagine that the individual traders are, one or two around the world have been, they are certainly the people actually committing these frauds, but then also those who are supposed to be responsible for overseeing, that is to say the people who are making so much money, the senior managers of these companies, these banks, and the directors.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've long argued on numerous speeches around the city and in Edinburgh and in Dublin and various other places that you can't really have a sane or well policed financial services sector until you punish people for wrongdoing, and it has to be individuals, not companies. So I totally agree that you have to, if someone has committed a fraud, the company should not be able to just do some kind of out of court settlement with a regulator, pay a few hundred million and say, right, that's all fine, let's get back to work, because that doesn't change behavior, that doesn't encourage any soul searching at the bank level. You have to prosecute individuals, and you have to prosecute people as high as you possibly can within the bank concerned.
Okay, so this is a $64,000 question. Why hasn't that been happening yet in Britain?
Well, because there's no appetite for it at a governmental level, and we've got an utterly incompetent prosecutorial agency called the SFO, which just seems utterly incapable of really doing anything.
The Serious Fraud Office.
Yeah. I mean, well, they are trying to prosecute Rain Man, Tom Hayes, who's ex-RBS, ex-UBS derivatives trader. You begin to lose faith in these people because they just seem to keep failing. Whenever they try and do a prosecution of high-level financial crime or white-collar crime, whatever you want to call it, in most cases they seem to cock it up and they just miss the mark, and then the person goes away, gets off scot-free. I can give you one particular example of nine people from HBOS who have been charged with a range of offences, including blackmail, fraudulent trading, conspiracy to defraud, and I can't remember what the other ones are. And these crimes, these alleged crimes, happened between 2003 and 2007. The police first started investigating the matter in 2010. The CPS sat on it for 2 years before they even decided to press charges. It's just that it's so dilatory. Dilatory, is that the right word? In the US, I'm not saying the US is ideal by any stretch of the imagination, but in the US, if this thing had happened, I believe that the whole thing in terms of the police investigation, the Crime Prosecution Service, the decision-making, and and the trial would have happened long ago. So there's just a general kind of lackadaisical approach in the UK, which enables people to think, you know, which makes people who are working in a financial institution think, you know, they're not constantly thinking at the back of their mind, God, if I do this, you know, I might seriously risk going to jail, because it's not something that happens.
It seems to almost be like a kind of schoolboy bully mentality, where they're saying to each other, well, look, I can get away with this, and they're competing to steal more money and to commit even greater crimes. There was a fascinating article in The Independent the other day. Serious fraud office has left shamefaced after the US nails a city fraudster. The serious fraud office is facing, this is from 9th of January, an article by Tom Harper. The serious fraud office is facing fresh embarrassment after the US authorities succeeded in a major anti-corruption prosecution centred on the City of London, just 1 month after the SFO failed to land a blow in the same case. So it seems that the only place that people from the city who commit fraud, crime, money laundering, etc., Ian, is going to be possibly be prosecuted by the Securities and Exchange Commission in America.
Yeah, it's pathetic, isn't it? And actually, that's very much what happened to the NatWest 3, who were working for NatWest in 1999-2000 and helped Enron to commit fraud. It's quite complicated, but they basically did aid and abet fraud on behalf of Enron's top management, and they didn't. You know, the UK authorities couldn't even be bothered to prosecute them. They were extradited in the end in 2005 or 2007, and they were jailed in the US after a case in Texas. But it's pretty scary that, you know, if Britain is really that utterly hopeless at prosecuting financial crime that we have to depend on the US authorities to do it for us, then what kind of country are we?
Well, surely we're the sort of country that attracts any gangster to London. Well, maybe that seems to be maybe one of the policies that's going on here, where they're saying, well, look, whoever it is that wants to do any kind of dodgy deals, if you come to the City of London, you can do it here, because you'll get away scot-free.
Yeah, part of my book is about how, you know, the attitude that Gordon Brown had towards the City of London throughout his time as Chancellor and as Prime Minister. And it was quite interesting that something happened in 2003, which was when George W. Bush passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which did really, really tighten up the rules and regulations around accounting in particular, and meant that if you, as a director of a company, presented inaccurate accounts, you could be jailed under Sarbanes-Oxley. Gordon Brown's response was to rub his hands with glee and say, great, London can now become a real centre for IPOs, which is initial private offerings or flotations of companies, and because no one's going to dare go to the in the States anymore, because they'll be so terrified of, you know, being put in jail if they get one figure wrong in their accounts. So, you know, he was trawling around Kazakhstan, Russia, India, Brazil, Mexico, other emerging markets to try and win business in terms of, you know, people from those countries who wanted to have IPOs for their large mining corporations or whatever they were in the City of London. And he was telling them, well, I don't know if he was directly doing it, but he and or his acolytes were telling these people, don't worry, you know, we won't jail you if it goes wrong. We're a soft touch.
Okay. Also, what did you make of the collapse of the Cooperative Bank? Because unlike RBS and Lloyds, this really was the people's bank. I mean, I certainly look at it and I think to myself, well, hang on a minute, it looks like that bank has just been sunk like with a torpedo.
Well, I was appalled because in March 2013, I actually moved my bank. I moved to Cooperative Bank from RBS because I thought I can't possibly stay with RBS, and I wanted a, you know, bank, an ethical bank. And then in April 2013, it was announced they had a £1.5 billion capital hole, which had been identified by the Prudential Regulation Authority, and they had to try and make this good. And the only way that they've been able to do that is basically to become controlled by two hedge funds based in the States. So I'm probably going to leave Cooperative Bank now. I'm certainly... You know, the Flowers thing also was a huge fiasco, obviously. You know, Paul Flowers, the Reverend Paul Flowers, who slightly, you know, had a few personal issues around about drinking and sex and God knows what. But as far as the cooperative bank is concerned, they even though it is now owned by two US hedge funds, it's probably now more secure than it was under the cooperative, so it may not be a bad thing. And they have said they are committed to the same ethical policies which it had under the cooperative. So, you know, who knows? But one of the most interesting things about the cooperative is that, what's his name? Andrew Bailey, who was set number two at the FSA at the time, was aware that it had some liquidity and capital issues in 2010-11, and yet he was still putting it forward, or the government was still putting it forward, as the preferred bidder for the Lloyds 632 branches, which Lloyds had to sell as part of a settlement with the EU. So, you know, here was a bank which, you know, the regulator knew had some serious capital and liquidity issues, and yet the government was proposing it and putting it forward as being the best bank to buy these 600 branches.
And of course, the accounts were all signed off from the co-op by good old KPMG. Finally, in anyway, what are your thoughts about the changes to payment cards? Because I've noticed that the banks are no longer issuing credit cards and debit cards without the contactless payment system. And we've seen stories in the news last year about people walking past Marks and Spencer's tills and finding money is just disappearing out of their bank account. Now, I mean, it doesn't sound very secure. It seems we're moving to a world where your bank account is less and less and less secure. The chip and PIN system. But this is a new kind of card which has been issued from last year. We're being forced down the road of contactless payment cards. I mean, I personally have written to my bank saying I don't want one of these, and they've said tough.
I'm afraid I don't actually know much about that, so I can't really add to what you've said, because I don't know enough about it, I'm afraid, on that particular one. Sorry.
Okie dokie. And just remind us of the title of your book and when it's out then.
Okay, the book is called Shredded, The Rise and Fall of the Royal Bank of Scotland, and it's published by Birlin, spelled B-I-R-L-I-N-N, and it will be published in either late April or early May. It's not that the exact date has yet to be finalised.
Okay, Ian Fraser, journalist, blogger, all-round expert on RBS from the people's point of view. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, good to hear from you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you have been telling me that we've got problems with some of the developing nations' currencies beginning to crash, looking a little bit shaky. Why is this? And what's going on, first of all, and why is it?
Well, because the Federal Reserve in the United States has decided that it is going to taper its quantitative easing. In other words, it's going to take the pull back the accelerator on printing money. They're not going to stop printing money. They're just not going to print quite as much as they were. What's happened, of course, is that the speculators were getting free money from the Federal Reserve and from the Bank of England, and then they take that money and invest it in emerging markets, which tend to have higher growth rates, and therefore they make an easy profit. But if interest rates are going to rise in the United States, if the economy in the United States is starting to pick up, then all that money, hot money as they call it, comes flooding back into the United States and into the City of London. But that, of course, is disastrous for the emerging market economies. And at first they were suggesting that when Argentina was having problems, that it was to do with the mismanagement of the Argentine government. They don't like the Argentine government because they've done things like nationalise the oil industry and so on. But it wasn't just that. It's that Turkey, which is a very, very much in favour with the neoliberals, that's also started to crash. So it's now spreading. You've got contagion spreading, and of course the danger here is that contagion will spread into the major stock markets, and the crash will come. I mean, all this fraud we were talking about a minute ago, this is the prelude to big crashes.
Okay. Also, Ukraine, Thailand, Egypt, also all having serious political problems,
and Russia. The same. You've got political problems, but it's not the political problems in these countries. You've got political problems in places like Ukraine and Thailand and so on, and in South Africa where you're about to have a miners strike in the platinum mines and so forth. But the real problem is that everything is connected to everything else. The economy's slowing down in China. There's a potential credit crunch there. Soros is predicting a crash starting in China. I just predict that there will be a crash at some point soon because the system basically has been out of control for years. We've just been hearing how out of control it actually is, and if it goes on for long enough, eventually that will implode.
Well, if it does implode, I mean, any ideas where and when? How? What are the signs for this kind of thing? I mean, you've already said that we've got signs at the moment.
The signs are starting to come forward. I mean, the problem that policymakers have got is that they want to actually start reining back on quantitative easing, but as soon as they do that, crisis breaks out everywhere. So they then have to put their foot back on the accelerator, which is what happened this time last year. But I think this time they've backed themselves into a corner where if they put their foot back on the accelerator, then in any case people will think they're panicking, so they've got to carry on trying to cut it back, but by doing that they're creating crises in all over the world as stock markets plummet.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now this week the Prime Minister announced something called a Holocaust Commission, but this week I would like to talk about something which did happen during the original Holocaust, which hasn't really been mentioned very much at all in the mainstream media, and it's connected with the Edward Snowden revelations. Now, Martin, this week we've heard that GCHQ's head, Sir Ian Lobban, is going to stand down. Do you think this could be connected with the Edward Snowden allegations, the allegations of criminality at GCHQ, warrantless wiretapping?
Well, it could be, couldn't it? But it's, I mean, I've never even heard of this chap before. We now find he's standing down. Who knows? I mean, people like that generally don't resign just because they want to spend more time with their families.
Also, another thing is that Edward Snowden has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by two Norwegian MPs.
Well, yes, and I think that's very revealing, isn't it?
As a nominee, I mean, did he sit very well next to Barack Obama and Henry Kissinger?
Well, the Nobel...
Joseph Stalin,
The Nobel Peace Prize, effectively, is a, you know, it's a political exercise. The Nobel Prize for Economics is even more politicised. It's given away by the Swedish Central Bank. It's not even given away by the Nobel Committee. I mean, basically, there is politicking around this, around the presentation of these international prizes. We all know that.
If we go back 60 years to the Nazi Holocaust, you'll find that American computer companies were very, very much involved in that. And let's hear now from the author of IBM and the Holocaust, Edwin Black.
When Hitler came to power in 1933, his goal was to dismantle and destroy the Jewish community. This was an enterprise so fast that it required the resources of a computer. But in 1933, there was no computer. What there was the IBM punch card system, which controlled and stored information based upon the holes that were punched in various rows and columns. Naturally, there was no off-the-shelf software as there is today. Each application was custom designed, and an engineer had to personally configure it. Millions of people of all religions and nationalities and characteristics went through the concentration camp system. That's an extraordinary traffic management program that required an IBM system in every railroad direction, and an IBM system in every concentration camp. Now, this is a typical prisoner card. There are little boxes where all the information is to be punched in. We compare this information to the code sheet for concentration camps, and here you see Auschwitz is 1, Buchenwald 2, Dachau is 3. Now, what kinds of prisoners were they? They could be a Jehovah's Witness for 2, a homosexual for 3, communist for 6, or a Jew would be 8. Now, what was their status? 1 was released, 2 was transferred, 4 was executed, 5 was suicide, and 6. Code 6, Sonderbehandlung, special treatment, meant the gas chamber or sometimes a bullet. They would punch that number in, the material was tabulated, the machines were set, and of course, the punch cards, by the millions, had to be printed, and they were printed exclusively by IBM, and the profits were recovered just after the war. IBM would, of course, say that it had no control over its German subsidiary. But here on October 9th of 1941, a letter is being written directly to Thomas J. Watson with all sorts of detail about the activities of the German subsidiary. None of these machines were sold. They were all leased by IBM, and they had to be serviced on site once a month, even if that was at a concentration camp such as Dachau-Buchenwald. This is a typical contract with IBM and the Third Reich, which was instituted in 1942. It's not with the Dutch subsidiary. It's not with the German subsidiary. It is with the IBM Corporation in New York.
Well, nerve-wracking stuff there. I mean, we're having a lot of consolidation of databases. One of them is the NHS database. I got a little freebie through the, a bit of junk mail through the door saying better information means better care. No information there about how to opt out. So the website to do, if you want to opt out from handing over your private confidential medical information to the government's central database then to be sold on, it's medconfidential.org. Now, Martin, let's just have a listen to Ken O'Keefe from last week. He is a former Marine, and here he is with his film about the September the 11th attacks on the People's Voice TV station.
Folks, we have only just begun to reveal the fingerprints of this crime scene. But the next question is, are we ready to face the truth? Well, I believe we are. So let us imagine a crime so audacious that it was practically advertised before it was even committed. In addition to the incredible act of false flag terrorism that is the 9/11 operation, I am talking about the supreme crime of aggression, defined by the International Criminal Court as the planning, preparation, initiation, or execution of an act using armed force by a state against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of another state. Well, that is precisely what these criminals in positions of public trust did. First they planned, then they boldly laid out those plans in two documents. The first one, written in 1996, was entitled Clean Break, a new strategy for securing the realm. And it argued for regime change in Iraq based on the pretext that Saddam Hussein was a security threat developing weapons of mass destruction. Sound familiar? The second document, written in 2000, called for much, much more than regime change. That document was entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. This document laid out a plan that would require multiple wars of aggression and occupation so as to achieve a goal of full spectrum dominance. The name of the group proposing these criminal policies was the Project for a New American Century, or PNAC. And their membership happens to read like a who's who in Jewish Israeli American politics. To be fair, the Project for a New American Century did have one token Islamic figure, or, to use the terminology of the late, great Malcolm X, a lone house Muslim. Getting back to the plans of PNAC and the goal of full-spectrum dominance, basically this involves the American empire establishing global control of air, land, sea, and space, and cyberspace. In order to achieve this goal, a primary objective was to seize the world's largest energy reserves, specifically the oil and gas reserves of the former Soviet republics in the Caspian Basin, as well as the oil of Iraq, the former requiring the control of a pipeline route to deliver said oil and gas to international markets. Another objective was to establish permanent military bases in this strategic area so as to ensure rapid deployment to any trouble spots where the natives might just get a little bit restless. Now, the PNAC plan complemented another goal known as the Greater Israel Project. Going back to statements from the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, the so-called Promised Land extends from the Nile River of Egypt to the Euphrates in Iraq. In Oded Yanan's A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, Israeli regional superiority was to be achieved through a process of reconfiguring the Middle East by the Balkanization of the surrounding Arab states into smaller and weaker states divided along sectarian lines. Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia were all in the crosshairs, but Israeli strategists viewed Iraq as their biggest challenge of all. And thus, Iraq was outlined as the centerpiece to the Balkanization of the Middle East. Iraq was to be divided into a Kurdish state, a Shiite Arab state, and a Sunni Arab state. The first step towards establishing this goal, however, was to instigate a war between Iraq and Iran, a war that would significantly weaken both states. So while Saddam Hussein served wonderfully as an attack dog against Iran, the moment he had fulfilled his utility, he became the butcher of Baghdad, and the Balkanization of Iraq merely required a pretext.
Martin, that was Ken O'Keefe, former US Marine. What are your thoughts generally on his connecting there with the what's going on in the Middle East to 9/11?
Well, it's an obvious connection to make, and of course it's not just the Israeli state that's behind 9/11. There's clearly elements within the US and probably the British states involved as well, but the Israelis certainly have a finger in it, because of, we've got evidence from the dancing Israelis that were shown to be filming the supposed surprise attack, and they went on Israeli television saying that they were from Mossad, but they were just documenting what was supposedly a surprise attack. Now, that doesn't mean that the Israelis are the only people involved, but they're certainly in the frame.
Okay, thanks very much. Time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7. Cyrus the Virus and Typical Topical Afro-Tropical coming up next, we hope. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins. I'm online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. Amanda Knox says she's going through waves of emotion after being found guilty again of murdering British student Meredith Kersher. She says she's going to continue to fight the case, including any potential attempt to extradite her from the US to